Luke chapter number 7. Thankful for the song service. I was reminded of the attitude I should have in the song service. My daughter was there with me, and she goes, "Dad, can you pick me up so they can hear me sing really loud at them?" And I said, "Sure." And the last verse, I picked her up so she could sing really loud. And I just reminded, that's really a good attitude to have, not for arrogance, but she wanted to sing praise the Lord, and she wanted to make sure others knew she was praising the Lord as well. Luke chapter 7, it's good to be back with you. In some ways, it's feel like a long time, but I am thankful for Pastor Pelfrey this last week with the Spiritual Renewal Conference. I hope that challenge helped, encouraged you as it did me. And then I'm thankful to have gotten to be in the Ivory Coast the week before there preaching with the brothers and sisters there in Grand-Bassan, and so thankful to get to do that. We're back in the Gospel of Luke. We're going through our series Every Day with Jesus, and we've just completed the Sermon on the Plain. And I just want to tell you, Pastor Jerry told us they went through Luke as like, what, 110 sermons? I'm feeling pretty good about catching him. This is like, I think, sermon number 30 today in Luke, so we're good. We got this thing. It's going well. He's completed the Sermon on the Plain there, as I say, and he's going now in the Galilee region, and you'll see that on the map there. So he's moving on. This is the general area. If you're looking at Israel, north, south, east, west, you have the Lake of Galilee in the northeast section. And that's what we're looking at right now, the northeast section. And so Jesus is traveling around the lake there, or traveling across the lake as well, doing ministry, preaching, teaching, healing, etc. So when you hear about the Galilee region, you just always know it's this northeast corner of the area there in Israel. So Jesus has been in that region now preaching and teaching, and now we come to Luke chapter number 7, and we have an amazing account with Jesus' interactions with other people. And in the account today, it's going to continue all through chapter 7, verifying he is the Messiah by his teachings, but then by his miraculous ability as well. But in today's passage 1 through 10, we love the account we find because it shows Jesus tearing down the prejudicial barriers of their day, and also at the same time giving the inclusivity of his promise of deliverance, forgiveness of sin, salvation that was available to anybody at their time, and also today as well. Further, it becomes a lesson for any of us as hearers or readers, hearers in their time, hearers and readers in our time, to recognize the basis of a relationship with God. As we go through this passage today, I hope you'll be helped, challenged, and encouraged to realize the basis of a relationship with God versus what religion tells us, or versus what our own intellect or our culture may say is the basis of a relationship with God. Now, this same account is found in Matthew chapter 8, verses 5 through 13, and there's slight differences, being that Matthew shows and says the centurion comes on his own to Jesus. Here in our passage, we're going to see that he sends people on his behalf. And while there may be differences between the two, it's really not something to get lost in, quote, the details, because just as our president would have somebody who speaks on his behalf and it's as good as the president speaking, so it is here the differences between Matthew and Luke. Now, we could bicker over these differences. It'd be foolish to miss the main point of Jesus' commendation, the commendation of the centurion's faith. So I want you to see this quote on the screen before we read our passage. In the Gospels, it is rare that someone receives a clear commendation from Jesus. And when it happens, it's an occasion for reflection. Now, think about this. Before we read the passage, when your mom told you you were the best at everything growing up, that's one thing, right? Moms are liars with good hearts. You're the best, sweetie. Yeah, about that, right? You're going to be a world changer. Flipping burgers, maybe. So, right. It's one thing if your boss says, hey, good quarter. But you know he's going to be looking for you to see what? The next quarter better be good as well, right? So it's one thing when somebody on earth gives us a commendation, even if it's somebody we know loves and cares about us. Can you imagine the God of the universe using you as a positive illustration for something that matters to him in eternity? That just blows my mind to think that there would be some response I would give to Jesus that he would say, now this is something to take note of. And that's what happens here in this passage. So the Gospel of Luke, please, chapter number 7. If you have a paper copy, open it to Psalms, Proverbs, go to the right, Matthew, Mark, Luke, or please Google and follow along, Matthew 7, Matthew chapter 7. Now, note what Dr. Luke records for us. Now, When Jesus had ended all his sayings in the Sermon on the Plain and the audience of the people, he entered into Capernaum, which you saw there on the map. And a certain centurion's servant who was dear unto him was sick. And how bad off is he? He's ready to die, it says. And when he, the centurion, heard of Jesus, he sent unto him the elders of the Jews, beseeching him that he would come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they besought him instantly, saying that he was worthy for whom he should do this. Why? For he loves our nation, and he hath built us a synagogue. Then Jesus went with them. Now, that little sentence there may not mean much, but I hope as we work through the message, you'll realize just how incredible that is of Jesus to do, and what an example it is for you and I and the modern-day prejudices we may hold in our hearts, and how Jesus obliterates the need for those prejudices. Not that there was ever need, but you understand the curse of sin. Know what he says here in verse 6. And when he was now not far from the centurion's house, the centurion sent friends to him, saying unto Jesus, Lord, trouble not thyself. For I am, what's the next two words? Not worthy. I'm not worthy that thou shouldest enter under my roof. Wherefore, neither thought I myself worthy to come unto thee. But say in a word, my servant shall be healed. For I also am a man set under authority, having under me soldiers. And I say unto one, go, and he goeth. And to another, come, and he cometh. And to my servant, do this, and he doeth it. Some of you military folks are feeling that, aren't you? Verse 9. And when Jesus heard these things, the centurion's attitude, the centurion's faith, what did he do? He marveled at him and turned him about and said unto the people that follow him, I say unto you, I have not found so great a faith, no, not in Israel. And they that were sent, returning to the house, found the servant whole that had been sick. Here in our passage, Jesus shows his divine authority by healing the servant of the Gentile. But in doing so, he also highlights his simple faith as an example to be followed. So he shows he's God, but at the same time, he teaches us a lesson that we can relate to as fellow human beings. And so what's the idea we want to walk away with today from this passage? Here it is. Jesus does not expect you to create your worthiness with efforts. He calls you to trust in his efforts as God. He doesn't say to you, be worthy. He doesn't say to you, create worth. Show that you are worthy of my love, my intervention, my care, my deliverance. He doesn't say that. He says, come to me, and based on who I am and what I've done, that's what you need to have trust or confidence in. So as we start this passage this morning, in verse 1 and 2, we're introduced to Jesus not only going about and teaching, but then he introduces us to the narrative, the characters in this narrative. So in verses 1 and 2, we find this centurion. It might immediately strike us. What is a centurion? Well, a centurion in the Roman army was an officer in charge of 100 men. Now, 6 centurions and their man served under a tribune. So get the idea. It's just Roman military structure, just like we'd have in our armed services as well. And in this instance, we know this is a Gentile man, not a Roman citizen, because of when Roman citizens began to do work in the armed forces. That happened after Jesus' death at 44 AD. So here this man is. He's a Gentile, and he's in service to Herod Antipas, who used non-Jewish soldiers. Maybe we could also insert a word here we're familiar with. This man is a Gentile mercenary, okay? It's a Gentile mercenary in a position of power and authority, and he has obligations as well. So in verse number 2, we find that this man has an issue. Now, given the characteristics of Rome, as an empire, given the characteristics of being so self-serving, you don't even have to be a great historian to know that, you would think his issue would be about him and his own well-being, his own betterment, wouldn't it? But check out in verse number 2, what's the problem that he has? It's something beyond his control. He has an unwell servant. Now, this passage just builds in its crescendo of layers for us to consider and get the tenseness and the beauty of the passage. The layers of this account add up because we have here this Gentile mercenary seeking out the help of Jesus. And what's the help of Jesus for? A slave. Just a slave. Oh, Paul, that sounds terrible. You can't just call him just a slave, devalue him like that. In their culture, you know what this person would have been valued as? Secondary class of citizen, all right? So for this Gentile mercenary to have a servant that he's so eaten up about, he's willing to go to the Jewish Messiah, this is significant. Why? Because in ancient Near Eastern times, slavery encompassed a spectrum of tasks. So you have people in indentured servitude in high-ranking positions all the way down to meaningful or non-meaningful. You'd have people who were essential and people who are just viewed as expendable or replaceable, if you'll forgive the idea there. It seems from the outset, though, this is different. This centurion has this servant that has value to him for some reason. And that's very bizarre because in the nation of Rome or the empire of Rome, you know what regard they had for human life? Very little. They had next to no value for human life. So for a Gentile mercenary serving the Roman Empire to be concerned about a servant, it just doesn't make sense for their day and for their time. We may not know what was going on with the relationship there, why there was value there. We don't know. But this is what we're given. And how bad does Luke describe it? Remember, Luke was a physician by trade. Matthew says that he was paralyzed and suffering, but Luke says it like this. He's in turmoil. He's in pain. He's sick. He is ready to die. So in verse number 3, when this centurion hears about Jesus, he makes a request. But it begs the question, right? When we read the passages, it's important for us to engage our brain. How did this Gentile mercenary know about a guy from Nazareth who's claiming to be the Messiah? Think about that, right? They didn't have Instagram. They weren't seeing those things online. There was no newspaper necessarily that he had picked up. So it makes us start asking ourselves some questions. How did he have exposure to Jesus? And I'd say he doesn't only have generic knowledge that there's a fella named Jesus of Nazareth. It seems he knows about Jesus. He has confidence in Jesus. He knows of his ability and even his willingness, perhaps. So again, another layer in the passage. What made him go from his attitude of superiority serving in the Roman Empire to becoming friendly and sympathetic to Jewish people, even seeking out the Jewish Messiah? Well, it could be that God had just worked through his conscience with general revelation, and the man had witnessed situations serving in the Empire of Rome that had made him recognize, well, there's not only more to this life, there has to be a creator in this life. It could be that. It could be, perhaps, that in the different situations he had had serving alongside people there in the nation of Israel, that he had recognized their faith, he had heard teachings about their God. It could be that. We may not know. Perhaps it was a Jewish individual who was obeying the law, anticipating the Messiah, and had spoken to him, hey, the anticipated Messiah is now on the scene, and here's what he's teaching, and here's what he's doing. That's all a bit of speculation. We may never know until heaven what happened to the centurion to make him knowledgeable and confident about Jesus of Nazareth being the Messiah, able to heal his servant. But I think it's safe to say that in some way, the God of the universe had sought him out, and in his desire to seek God out and hear from God and look to God, God had intervened in this centurion's life, and he had accepted the claims of Jesus of Nazareth on his behalf. Again, on the surface, it may not strike you or I as significant. So let me do my best, if I could, to try to give the contrast a parallel in our culture. At the risk of sounding insensitive, I'm trying to give us a frail idea of just how wild or unusual this is, that a Gentile mercenary man has a servant he's concerned about, and he is then going to a man who's claiming to be the Jewish Messiah. Let me give you maybe stark ideas in history to try to give us a jar on this. Imagine it's 1950. And a local white business owner who's a local Klan chapter leader converts to Christianity by listening to a younger black blue-collar worker. Is that stunning to think about? Oh, that never happened, Pastor. Let's try another stark idea. Perhaps it's modern-day Iran, and one of the government officials converts to Christianity due to the testimony of an Israeli woman. I mean, how much more stark can it get? That's how unusual it is for this Gentile mercenary caring for a servant to seek out the Jewish Messiah for his intervention and for his help. It's just wild. The whole passage is filled with peculiarities and prejudicial barriers being obliterated. So what happens in verse number 3 there? He sends his friends on behalf of him and his servant, and he sends what seems to be some Jewish elders. Now, these aren't people who hold religious positions. These are people who are renowned in the community. They're well-known business leaders. Maybe they're aged and they have their wisdom and they're kind and gracious. They're just well-known leaders in the Jewish community. And so these reputable men approach Jesus of Nazareth, who is becoming an ever controversial figure, and they do what? They beseech him. Now catch this. They approach Jesus, and they seem to share the centurion's belief about who Jesus is and what he's able to do. Look what it says there in verse number 3. The elders of the Jews, and what did they do there at the end of the verse? Beseeching Jesus that he would come and heal his servant. So on behalf of the centurion, a Gentile mercenary, Jewish men are aligned with him, and they go to Jesus, and they beseech him. Now, the idea of beseech, not a word we use a ton these days, right? But the idea of beseech is they have this passionate request. They're making it of someone they know has the capacity to respond or has the willingness to respond. And so they come on behalf of the centurion, and they beseech Jesus to do what? To heal the servant. Now, the centurion of men believe Jesus has the ability to do what is beyond their control medically. Now, I fear sometimes if we've been in church a bit, we read to heal the centurion, and we're like, yeah, of course, because we believe in Jesus, don't we? I said, we believe in Jesus, don't we? There, so, whew, I was like, maybe I'm in the wrong crowd today, right? We believe in Jesus, yeah. And so we read Jesus could heal, and it just doesn't even maybe peg as strong as it could on our radar or ping on our radar, because what? We're like, well, of course Jesus could heal. He's the God of the universe. He's the creator and sustainer, Colossians 1. We know he has capacity. But put ourselves here. This is beyond his control medically. What they're requesting is impossible. Maybe gut check ourselves and how we read the Bible and not lose the awe and wonder we should. Put it like this in an illustration. When's the last time you asked your doctor to care for your diabetes without insulin? Or you received an unfortunate diagnosis, I don't want to be insensitive here, of cancer, and you said, let's not use chemo or radiation ever. Or you went to your eye doctor, ophthalmologist, optician, whatever they are, right? Nobody knows. And you said, hey, I'd like to get rid of my nearsightedness and not have to either have a surgery or glasses or contacts. Or you address your hair loss. No, I don't want to talk about that, right? But think about that. If I said to you, hey, this week, and I filled in one of those scenarios, you would look at me and say what? Good luck. Okay. Yeah, good luck on that request. I don't see that happening. That's what's going on here. The centurion says, my servant is about to die. Jesus, heal him. Well, what does he have? Heal him. Just do it. Can you take care of what is well beyond my control? My friends, they anticipate Jesus has the ability to accomplish the miraculous and the supernatural, and there is no other reason for these distinguished, educated men to approach Jesus otherwise, neither the Gentile mercenary or the elders of the Jewish community. So in verse 4 and 5, those who come and beseech Jesus on the centurion's behalf, they kind of give their idea of why he is a worthy candidate. The estimation of the centurion's emissaries is this, that he's a worthy candidate to receive Jesus's help. Listen to their underlying thought process as to why Jesus should help the centurion and heal the servant. What do they say in verse 4 and 5 there? He says, and when they came to Jesus, they besought him that he may be, that why, in the end there, that he was worthy for whom he should do this. Why? He loves our nation. He built us a synagogue. So the emissaries come and give the request of the centurion, and then they give their commentary on the requester of it, the miracle. He's worthy. The idea here of the word worth is that he's got what? He's good. This man's deserving. He's earned a particular treatment or status. Jesus, you should hear this. You should do this. And so it begs the question, why is he worthy in their mind? And what are they comparing him against to establish his worthiness? So they give us the evidence. What do they say? He loves our nation. He's a Gentile mercenary who is acting on behalf of our occupiers, the Roman Empire. And unlike everybody else that we've run across for the most part in that regime, who seems so self-centered, so ambitious as soldiers and officials, this man actually cares for us as Israelis. But if that weren't enough, what did he do? He made sure they had their synagogue built. That granted them a place to do what? The synagogue in their culture was a center of teaching about the Old Testament, as a center of community, as a center of living out their faith in Messiah. And so they had the synagogue built. And I don't know that I could say with clarity that he had the authority to build the synagogue. It seems more likely he was a generous benefactor for the synagogue to be constructed. And so this man not only treats them well, what's he also apparently done? It seems he's put his money where his mouth is. So they come to Jesus and say, hey, this fella is worthy. It makes us think maybe that the centurion is what they would call in their day and time a God-fearer. He believed in Judaism. He believed in the moral law, but he hadn't quite converted over to Judaism yet. And so in their day and time, they called him God-fearers. You think Cornelius would be kind of like that in the book of Acts. So maybe we could sum up the request of the elders this way. Jesus, you should listen to this man's request, and you should grant this man's request because he's done a lot of good things for us in our opinion, and he's not evil in our opinion. Now, it's interesting we catch that from them, because as we've already read, we know that is not the centurion's opinion of himself, nor does he see any of what he's done as gaining him a standing or an audience with Jesus or the God of the universe, right? He doesn't see himself as worthy. So here's this tense moment. Jesus is already a controversial figure, becoming ever more so. Some Jewish elders have come to him who should despise him like other Jewish elders and leaders and religious leaders are, but they believe and entreat him, and they entreat him on behalf of a Gentile who they should all just be repugnant towards, because in their culture that was such a nasty prejudice they held back and forth, Jewish and Gentile. And here Jesus, and what I would just say is a countercultural move, a Jewish man going to help a Gentile man, he embarks and agrees to go. In verses 6 through 8, Jesus agrees to go with the group to the house, and along the way, the centurion in some fashion received notice. Jesus has said yes. Jesus is on the way. He's going to come and take care of your request with your servant. Now, we don't know who did that. Somebody run ahead? Well, we don't know. It doesn't really matter. Here's his response. When he hears Jesus is willing to help his servant, what's his response there, and what is it now? Verse number 6, what's he say there? The centurion said, Lord, what? Trouble not thyself. The idea of trouble not is this idea. They would use it in this way. You don't need to be harassing someone or be harassed. I don't want somebody to be wearied. Don't be bothered. Don't be annoyed. The sense is this. I don't want you to face discomfort. I don't want to face inconvenience at all. So the centurion says that, Jesus, you don't need to have your day interrupted any further. That's a little weird, isn't it? You've made the request. You need him healed. But now when you hear Jesus is on the way, he said, nah, don't worry about it. Stop dead in your tracks, Jesus. I'll give you two possible ideas why I think the text bears out the second one to be clear. The first idea is this. The centurion doesn't see himself as worthy of Jesus' presence in his house. And he knows this. Jesus, by Jewish standards, coming into his house as a Gentile would make him religiously or ceremonially unclean. He sits there and he says, I'm not the ideal candidate. It doesn't matter what others have told you I've done. I don't deserve you in my presence in my house. But I think beyond self-deprecation, we recognize the greater rationale for the centurion. He doesn't want Jesus to be inconvenienced, not just because he sees himself as unworthy, but because of his faith in who Jesus is. He had faith that Jesus had all the authority necessary as the Messiah to do what? To just give the command. You don't even have to be here, Jesus. Don't make the rest of the journey, Jesus. Don't come under my roof, Jesus. I'm not worthy, but really, even if I was, you didn't have to come. All I need you to do is give the word, and I know it will come to pass. What's his frame of reference, you ask? Has he been there for the Sermon on the Plain? Has he watched Jesus do miracles in the past? Was he there at the first miracle at the wedding of Cana? No. Here's his rationale, verse number 8. It's his military station. His position carried with it the ability for him to utilize those under his authority at his discretion. Catch it. Whatever the task was, if this centurion deemed it needed doing, and he deemed he had available personnel to do it, what would he do? He'd give a command, and those who were commanded had to do what? Those who are commanded better do what? Do what they're told. Go get this done. He has the sphere of authority to say so. He has, hopefully, a goodness or kindness about him in his thought process to not ask the unreasonable of someone who's incapable, or incapable, I should say, to do it. But when there's a duty to be done, and he commanded it to be done, he expected there to be submission and completion of the assigned task. Now, this just blows my mind. This was what he could do as a man who was under other authority in the empire. The centurion's not the emperor, is he? He's just one of many centurions, maybe hundreds or thousands of centurions. He's a man under authority, and he has people under him in authority, and he knows this dynamic in just that frail and limited way. You know what he's expressing to Jesus here? If this is what I can do and my frail structure of authority, what can you, the God of the cosmos, not be able to do? Here's what I have. Here's the unlimited reach of what you have in your capacity and with your ability. He's expressing his trust in Jesus' divine authority over the realm of disease and his ability to do the impossible because of his status as the Messiah. Maybe we can summarize his comments this way. If he knew what it was to use his authority to order matters to be done, how much more can Jesus and does Jesus know in his holiness and his goodness? Now, before we go further beyond this, forgive me a little side note, if you would. His understanding of Jesus' lordship and the subsequent impact it made upon his life is probably something that you and I, as modern-day Christians, could learn a lesson from. He says, here's a need I have, not because of my worth, but because of who you are and what you're able to do, and I believe you have the authority to do so, and I'm submitting myself to what you are more than capable, worthy, and able to do, and so I'm pleading for your help in this. You're God, I'm not. My concern would be that we often have people more consumed and concerned with this realm and how it operates in normality, if you would, rather than Jesus' realm and his rule in their life. I'm not talking about unbelievers here, okay? I don't expect an unbeliever to live righteously. Maybe self-righteously, but not righteously. I don't expect an unbeliever to submit to the commands of Christ and the transformation of Christ and the desire of Christ in their life. No, not at all. But for those who claim to be his followers, like this centurion, well, Jesus' lordship is without question. The ever-growing need to submit ourselves and grow in that is without question. My concern is we have men and women fine to claim the name of Jesus as long as he doesn't want to be Lord over their porn addiction. I don't know if my mic's on or not. We have women ready to post online about Jesus being their sufficiency, but then not let him give them any guidance about their value of their life or their value in the home versus what culture tells them. You have parents more concerned and grieved with what a principal, a teacher, a coach, a pastor, a deacon, a friend has, quote, said or done to them than they are concerned about their child's response to those. I had the privilege of working in our daughter's school system last year. It was great, except for the parents. You all at that school, you spit on my child and kicked them and put them in the middle of the floor and they just had to weep all day. That's what they told me. You think that's what happened? Yes, I believe my child. You should listen to your child. You shouldn't believe every word they say, right? And it was astonishing to me, and I mean this sadly, because I'm a pastor, all of a sudden everybody wants to be a Christian around me, or disdain, one of the two, there's no in between, that I watch Christian parents behave in godless ways with people in the administration while not even caring about supposedly their Christian child's behavior, attitude, and expressions, and they didn't even worry about that. This is the big problem. We should be more concerned about Jesus' lordship in our lives in a tangible, manifested way, like the centurion had, than claiming and then living like this realm. Living in a way that makes it no different in unrighteous behaviors and unrighteous motivations, but wanting the badge of Christian when it sure comes handy and due. The centurion, I suspect, would scratch his head sometimes at us, my own life included, and say, I called a man who I didn't expect to have even an opportunity with because of my worth, but I knew who he was. I submitted to whatever he wanted. I believed he had the authority and capacity to do that. That's the kind of faith he had. What was Jesus' response to this Gentile? By culture, he should hate and prejudice. What was his response to this Gentile mercenary who sent Jewish people on his behalf and then told him, don't bother with coming anymore. Just give a word. That's all I need. Look what he says in verse 9. This just blows my mind. Verse 9, Jesus heard these things. How does it describe Jesus' response there? What did he do? He marveled. Now, I get it. There's times we can marvel in a bad way. Like, how did that happen? What were they thinking, right? But context helps us here. We know that's not what Jesus is doing. He's marveling at the man's faith. The idea here of marvel is the feeling of wonder or amazement. The context tells it's a positive thing, right? One author said it like this: Jesus is said to be amazed only here and in Matthew's parallel account about this in chapter 8 and in Mark 6:6, but he's astonished and marveling there at unbelief, the stark other end of the spectrum. So catch this. Luke doesn't use this on accident. He says, pay attention. It struck Jesus, not by surprise, but by the expression he wanted others to learn from it, that he is marveling at this Gentile mercenary's faith. Again, I say it. This is not because Jesus was surprised due to ignorance. It was wonder and amazement due to the entirety of the circumstances. This Gentile man recognizes his inability to validate his worth to Jesus, to try to curry favor from Jesus, but instead does what? Trusts him as the Messiah to have the ability to accomplish what he is powerless to do. And he believes it in absolute faith and surrender. What's Jesus' commentary on the man? I have not found this kind of faith, not in Israel. This Gentile mercenary, I'm finding something peculiar in a good way, something special, something odd in a good way by contrast to what I'm walking around and seeing in my own covenant people. Let that sink in. Jesus not only emphasized the depth, but the quality of the centurion's faith contrasted against Israel. If we could put it this way, Jesus is like he's saying in this moment, above the centurion, there should be a massive neon arrow just blinking. This is who you should be like. This is who you should emulate. This is what I want to see. This is what is possible because I'm the Messiah. It should just be blinking above the man for everybody to see, this Gentile mercenary serving in the Roman Empire. And given that contrast, like, I haven't even found this in Israel. Somebody would step back and say, wow, that's audacity. The audacity of Jesus to say he hasn't found faith like this in Israel. I mean, you've never seen it like this in Israel. Think about what Jesus is saying by that statement. Israel received the law from God himself in spectacular fashion. What? Not once, but twice. Israel witnessed the miracles, the provision of God by bringing them into Egypt when there was a famine, the provision of God by moving them out and rescuing them from slavery from Pharaoh, the parting of the Red Sea onto dry ground, the use of military victory over and over without the use of any weapons. Israel had seen God do the impossible, and then they'd been used by God to accomplish the impossible by God as well. They constructed a tabernacle in the wilderness as a bunch of wandering nomads. They established a lavish temple that had such global fame, people traveled to verify if that had happened or not. They saw military success after success, even though they were consistently at a numerical disadvantage or a tactical disadvantage. God had used the nation of Israel to do what? To record his word. God continued speaking through the prophets throughout the years to come to construct the books of the Bible that are consistent and congruent unlike any other religious work historically. The nation had been nothing but a people of faith and miracle over and over and over again. And Jesus says to this nation, I'm not finding any faith like this. Where did Israel find themselves as the covenant people, even with all that backdrop? The majority are unbelieving, self-righteous, and a gross stumbling block to anyone who would have come to Jehovah as Messiah and Savior and help. The very role they were supposed to have, they've abdicated, and they filled it with a very sad counterfeit, which is religion and customs and traditions, and that's how they were living. So the reason Jesus is astounded at the centurion's faith is not because of his pedigree. It's not because of the position he holds or what he could offer Jesus. You know why Jesus marveled at his faith? It's because he was willing to embrace the reality between himself and Jesus. He was needy. Jesus was able and sufficient. He didn't bring anything to the table. He had to rely upon what Jesus had in entirety around the table. No mere self-reliance, no self-righteousness, not even self-condemnation, just what? Simple trust in Jesus. He didn't have the law. He hadn't had the background of the power of God working in his life like Israel. He hadn't seen all the miracles happen in his life and in his nation. He had heard of Christ. He'd seen the evidence of what faith in Christ was able to do and how it changed the lives of those who trusted him, and on and on and on. So please catch it as we come down to a conclusion. This beautiful passage tells us that being unworthy is a universal situation. This man wasn't unworthy because he was a Gentile, though that's what the prejudice of the culture told him. You were a lesser person. No, no, no. He was unworthy because that's the universal human condition. Let's say it bluntly. The rich white person with their college degree and better environmental upbringing is as unworthy as the substance-using, prison-cycling white person who had an horrific upbringing. The well-established and respected black civic leader is an equally unworthy as the OG who is influencing younger black men to do dirt for their gang. The married couple trying to do their best to raise their kids to be helpful citizens are as unworthy before God as the mom or dad who are trying to traffic out their children. Now, that reality is horrific and offensive to us, isn't it? It's horrific and offensive, but let me submit to you, it's also soothing. It's horrific and offensive because we think in consequences and merits. That's how we think. Consequences, merits. And I understand some of the scenarios I mentioned seem like people are good and should be rewarded, while others should bear the full weight of their consequence and even have judicial matters against them. And I wouldn't maybe disagree with that. But here's the problem as human beings. We hear those scenarios, and what we automatically do in temptation is what? I'm not like, and we give a comparison. I'm not like that Democrat. I'm not like that Republican. I'm not like that boss I had once. I'm not like that marriage I saw destroyed. I'm not like, and we want to self-justify, on and on we go, as if we had worth towards God, or we're building it. But catch it, friends, that's not how God's economy works. That's not how our relationship with him operates. That's why universal unworthiness, while it's frustrating, is actually soothing. Why? God knows you're unworthy. That's not a surprise to him. Further than that, he doesn't ask you to try to make yourself worthy. He doesn't want your help in becoming worthy. He merely expresses to us the need to trust and the only bridge available, the only mediator available for you and I to go from unworthy to worthy child adopted by him. From spiritually impoverished to spiritually wealthy. He expects us to recognize our unworthiness. So what's the difference between the two? The recognition of our need. No one has ever gotten to God on their merits or worth. No one has ever gotten to God by turning your life around. No one's ever gotten to God by turning a new leaf over. No one's ever gotten to God by being a better person or a moralist. No one has ever had anything from God by doing that. And what do? In humility, recognize who we are before God, what he's promised and because of who he is, and ask. Faith. Trust, if you prefer the word. Repentance, I quit trusting and believing and living for someone or something, and I put my confidence in who Jesus is and what he has done on my behalf, knowing I don't deserve it, can't earn it, and I don't have to. That's the beautiful reality, because Jesus came because I can't. And he's willing to negotiate on his death, his burial, and his resurrection, our release from the clutches of Satan and hell forever, and deliverance into his kingdom and into fellowship with him here and now. What's glorious is when we realize God promises to respond to humility. What did he say in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5:3? Blessed are the poor in spirit. They're blessed. Why? Because then God will come to them and intervene. What did he say in the book of James? Draw nigh, and guess what he promises he'll do? I'll draw nigh, James 4:6-10. See, today, my friends, if we accept the example of the centurion and we will submit ourselves in faith to Jesus as he did, we can find Jesus' intervention and help. And it doesn't take your efforts, and it doesn't take your works. It takes trust and submission to Christ. My friends, it's a beautiful story where prejudice is broken, faith is exalted, and our unworthiness is transformed by the worthiness of Jesus. I just ask you today, if Jesus is willing to do that in the life of a Gentile mercenary, with all he had done in the past, we probably don't want to know, honestly. What about you? Is Jesus not able to forgive and change and transform? Whether you think you've lived the most scandalous life, or yet maybe you see yourself as not scandalous, as actually deserving, Jesus is willing to die for all the sins, including self-sufficiency and self-righteousness, and is willing to forgive you right now today. If you're here as a follower of Christ, my encouragement would be to you based on the centurion's faith is this. Are we living in a way that reflects the lordship of Christ in the way he responded? Our flesh and our culture and our surroundings and our circumstances, our feelings, they want to pull us away from faith in Jesus and have reasons why he's not sufficient or enough. And yet the centurion just said, just say the word. I know who you are. I know what you're able to do. Say the word. And that's probably a reminder we need to have throughout the week about what we face when we face it. So this morning we close with the idea, Jesus doesn't expect you to create your worthiness with efforts. He is calling you to trust in him as God. If you want to talk about Christ today, we want you to have that conversation. Watch online. Stay put for just two more minutes as we have a quick video answering some of your questions about who Jesus is, and then reach out to us. Here today, we'll have people in the foyer ready to help you, ready to talk with you, answer any questions you have. And listen, I'm not talking to people who maybe it's your first time here. Every church has people who have been in church, been around Jesus, but have never been transformed by Jesus. If that's you today, don't let any embarrassment hold you back. Walk out and start that relationship with Jesus. There's probably a brother or sister in the room who needs to come back and just remember, that's our good, kind, interceding Savior who loves me and isn't asking me to create worth. I rest in his worthiness, and I can have great faith because of who he is and what he's able to do in my life. So if you're struggling with something today, something in your heart, a choice you have, a situation you can't control, you know Jesus knows, and he's able, and he's at work, and he's willing. Let's come back and trust to that, all right?